Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. In 1845, two ships and 129 men left Greenland with the hope of locating the Northwest Passage. They never returned and were lost to human history. Within the last few years, thanks to modern science, technology, and exploration, those two ships have been located. Steam Cafe is tonight at 6 p.m. Mountain Time inside Hay Camp Brewing Company in Rapid City. John Dreyer is an associate professor in the Department of Social Sciences at the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. His talk tonight is called Into the Frozen Abyss, the Franklin Expedition of 1845, and he joins us today from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital Studio inside SDPB's Rapid City Studios. John Dreyer, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
This is a fascinating story partially because it takes us back to a very particular historic time of exploration. Tell us a little bit about what was being sought and discovered in the mid-1800s.
Well, the Franklin Expedition was the last-ditch attempt by the British to force a passage in the north. They were looking for a shorter trade route to China, than having to go through under South America or Africa, which was fairly dangerous. And so they equipped these two ships, state-of-the-art in every way, shape, and form, and sent them off. The idea was to do about 3 years. They'd break through, go to China, and boom, the passage would be discovered.
What could go wrong?
Exactly.
All right. What went wrong?
Well, first of all, the Franklin Expedition, we've never recovered any journals, any notes. That's one of the biggest missing puzzle pieces. So we have to rely on science, on Inuit testimony. And most likely what we think happened is that the canned food they used had a lot of lead, like a lot of lead. And this led to, of course, lead poisoning. And apparently, from what science can determine, the lead poisoning would exacerbate existing issues with many of the men. And that was the first thing, because if you look at the casualty lists, 9 officers died within 3 years. That's a lot. And second, the ships most likely were trapped in ice. They couldn't get out of the ice. So they weren't going anywhere. So their food supplies are dwindling. Their coal's dwindling. Sailors and officers are dying. What else? You have to save yourself at some point. And so they abandon the ships and they start going south. And that's we lose track of them after King William Island, which is in the far north of Canada.
They go south on foot.
Yep, on foot, dragging. They made sleds for their smaller boats. Oak sleds, heavy sleds. You have men who are weakened by scurvy, starvation, they're cold, and they're dragging these impossibly heavy sledges southwards on foot.
Mm. So they're pretty desperate when they set out. They certainly didn't plan for that part of the trip. How long has this been a mystery?
Well, the first search expeditions were sent out in 1848, 1849. And nothing was really found until 1857, when they finally started to find not just bones, but also artifacts, lots of artifacts. And at the time, of course, in the mid-19th century, the Inuit had a lot to say, but nobody listened to them. We started putting together the pieces finally in the 1870s, and it took, a long time to incorporate that Inuit testimony as to what happened to these men. So probably by the 1980s, and with an expedition exhumed the 3 known graves on a place called Beachy Island. And that's when a lot of the puzzle pieces started to kind of come together as to what happened.
What did investigators learn from the Inuit people from that oral history?
The Inuit, of course, they reported that, hey, we saw a large group of starving men going south. We gave them seal meat. We saw these two ships. We boarded one of the ships. We found bodies on board. We saw these, we saw a camp with bodies in it. And a lot of that was in the 19th century, of course, was disregarded by searchers, by the public at large. And even worse, a lot of the public believed that the Inuit had ignored the men. But in the polar environment, where life is on a razor thin margin, you can't support, 100 plus starving Englishmen, if you were a small Inuit community. And so, the Inuit were seen in a very negative light. Now, in the 80s, 90s, and the 2000s, several of the researchers were Inuit, and they dug through oral histories and stories that had passed down, and they actually knew where the ships were prior to their discovery in 2012 and 2014, but they never told anybody because they didn't want to be spotlighted.
Interesting. So 2012, 2014, the actual ships are discovered. Tell me the story about how that discovery unfolded.
In 2012, we found the Erebus. She was the bigger of the two. She was Sir John's flagship. It was a air search, and they saw an anomaly in the ice. There was something there, something big. And Parks Canada, who is the major driver for all this, sent a small expedition up there. And lo and behold, in fairly shallow water is the Erebus. And then 2 years later, in 2014, they do something similar. And this is actually really funny. The place that the HMS Terrors found is called Terror Bay. And so the HMS Terrors found 2 years later.
Like coincidentally, or was it named after...
It was named after the ship.
Okay, it was. And that's where they found it.
And that's where they found it. It's actually a really funny story.
Maybe they should have looked there first.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought.
A few indicators. And so the ships are... They're not. Are they sunk?
Yes, they're sunk.
They're sunk now.
Erebus has significant damage to her stern area, but Terror. One of the first stories I read about HMS Terror is that it looks pristine. It's sunk, of course, but it's in good shape. It's battened down. It's like basically somebody house kept it before they left.
Interesting.
And right now, Parks Canada, and one of the big problems with archaeology.
Okay, wait. It's because they were going to go back? Why would they have sort of battened down the hatches before they left is what I'm wondering.
Naval discipline, most likely. We think that after the crew abandoned ship, we think what happened is that some of them split off and went back to the ship. So we think that Terror got remanned at one point. But we're not really sure. But yeah, naval discipline would lead to that. You're going to clean the ship up, make her spick and span, batten down the hatches, and that's what you do.
So she wasn't sunk when they abandoned them. That happened after.
No.
Fascinating. All right, so how is science and technology sort of, solved some of these mysteries? Because there's a lot converging here. You have this oral history of an indigenous people, and then you have, the latest in scientific and archaeological research. They come together to solve a mystery.
In the 80s, Owen Beatty, he was a forensic anthropologist. He dug up the three bodies on Beachy Island, and he used, science and medical techniques to determine lead poisoning, cause of death, things like that. And these bodies are perfectly preserved, as perfectly as you can get. And then in the 2000s, you have air search techniques. You have like air-based sonar, air-based magnetic anomaly. You can detect that stuff through the ice. Mm-hmm. So, science proved pretty important in finding the ships. And then science, I think, has played a key role in, at least we can speculate on the cause of death and the cause of the failure of the expedition.
All right, but no notes, no journals, no ship's logs. How come?
Nothing. What I think happened was that when they abandoned ship, they took everything with them.
Sure.
And according to Inuit testimony, Inuit oral histories, the Inuit found this, found papers, they found journals. But what good is this to a people that, again, live on a razor-thin margin of survival? So they gave it to the children to play with. I could just feel some of the search explorers, like Charles Francis Haugh, an American, just pulling his hair out at this. He's so close, but he's so far away.
Well, and likewise, the misunderstanding in the other regard that the Inuit weren't their testimony is not taken seriously at all because it's an oral history. So what one culture values is what the other culture doesn't understand.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, and then those stories are lost. What's your interest in this? Where did you've been researching this for a long time?
It's a hobby of mine.
Yeah.
I picked up a book years ago and I discovered that there's not just the Franklin Expedition, but, the race for the South Pole and all that. And it's fascinating. You see elements of leadership. You see personalities at work. You see there, you know, you see some explorers fighting the cold and others working with it. And the Franklin expedition, you know, I like to say, you know, there's a book on one of the books about the Franklin expedition trying to figure out what happened introduces UFOs. So that means that's a good story then, because somebody had to put UFOs in there somewhere.
What?
So,
So you mentioned other so I'm thinking, was it Shackelford who the other ill-fated expedition in the southern?
Oh, Shackleton, yeah.
Shackleton, thank you very much.
Oh, no problem. That was 1913, and he lost his ship, but he saved all of his men.
Right.
And that's actually kind of what initially got me into a lot of this stuff was there was a big renaissance of Shackleton about 10, 15 years ago. And then I discovered the discoverer of the South Pole, a Norwegian named Roald Amundsen.
Yeah.
And he is just absolutely the most fascinating person. He actually found the Northwest Passage. First, he sailed a tiny little fishing ship through it. It took him 3-4 years.
Okay, so why, when you look at these three explorers that we've just named, why are some successful and some not? Is it luck? Is it the time and the way that they were organized? Is it leadership? What are you finding out?
Just about everything you said there. The Franklin expedition was huge. 129 men, two really stout ships. You know, they're fighting the elements. They're blowing up the ice. They use dynamite. Then you had Roald Amundsen, who did it in the early 20th century. He used a tiny ship, very few men. He used Inuit techniques. He used, you know, he dressed in traditional Inuit furs, things like that. He adapted. He overcame. The Franklin expedition and the British at large, every time they would pursue Arctic or Antarctic exploration, they would just actively fight it rather than work with it. They wouldn't learn from the Inuit. Amundsen and his contemporary Nansen did.
Hmm. What was at stake as far? What's the prize at that point? Does it end up paying off to being the person who makes it through, or is it just a, you know, for us something to care about now?
It doesn't pay off. Amundsen was bankrupt. After his 1912 pole success. And he was particularly disliked by the British because they felt he had upstaged Robert Falcon Scott, who had died on his attempt. The Northwest Passage, as we know now, is now more open for commerce because a lot of the ice has melted. But at the time, even finding it, it wouldn't have done much because icing conditions and the inability of ships to break through the ice at that point in time would have rendered it useless. You would have had, of course, you know, glitter and gold, but not much else.
All right, Steam Cafe tonight, 6 p.m. Mountain at Hay Camp Brewing Company. Professor John Dreyer is with the School of Mines and Technology in the Department of Social Sciences, and I bet we could have a whole other conversation about exploration today and working with the elements, working against them, and what it means for the environment that we explore some other time.
Yeah, hopefully.
All right. Thanks so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.